The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Timothy James Berge. For the appellant, Mr. Berge, is Mr. Brad Schreiber, an attorney from Belle Fouche. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Gary Campbell, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Schreiber, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May I please support Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Campbell. I'm going to apologize right offhand. It's been 16 years since I've been in this position, so I'm a little out of practice for the oral argument.
Well, why don't you wait till you see if you make any mistakes?
Okay, thank you. I was court appointed on this case back in 2004. And basically, there are just three issues before this court at this time, and simply stated whether or not there is reasonable suspicion to stop my client in this case. I also had made the reliability of the drug dog in this case, and I also had made a motion on behalf of my client for a court-appointed expert in this case. And I'm going to start with the facts, and I'm going to stick to the relevant facts concerning the issues. Back in February 26, 2004, two police officers from Belle Fouche were on patrol. It was in the early morning hours, I believe. Facts indicated it's 12:45 a.m. to 1 o'clock a.m. One of them was Officer Setter. Now, Officer Setter was a canine officer for the Belle Fouche Police Department. He was sitting at a location in Belle Fouche, which was at the top of National Street, as an elevated location looking over the city. I believe he had a set of binoculars. The other officer on duty on this particular night was Officer Russell Waterbury, who was actually on patrol in the city. While Officer Setter was sitting up there, and the reason he was up there is because 3 days before that and 2 days before that, there had been a series of burglaries in Belle Fouche. The first two nights, I believe it was the 18th and 19th, there were approximately three or four businesses in Belle Fouche that had been broken into. About three nights later, there were, I think, two other businesses that had been broken into. So what had happened is they had directions to keep an eye on the city at this particular time. That's why Officer Setter was positioned where he was in Belle Fouche from this elevated position to keep an eye on the businesses to see what was going on. At the times that I indicated, approximately 12:45 a.m., Officer Setter was looking off to the south of Belle Fouche. On the south end of town is the Big D convenience store. And he saw a vehicle pulling out of the parking lot, which he described as a pickup without any headlights on. His testimony is that is the only vehicle that he saw pulling out of the parking lot at that time. What he did is he radioed this information to Officer Waterbury. There's an older style pickup, I believe is how he described it, with its headlights off, pulling out of the Big D parking lot. And it had started to go south on Highway 85 in Belle Fouche, that's also Fifth Avenue. So it was basically headed towards Spearfish is what it was doing. Officer Waterbury, and I believe Officer Setter testified that he actually saw Officer Waterbury's location from that position, and he was also on Fifth Avenue, Highway 85. And he saw Officer Waterbury turn around and go towards the Big D. The only communication, the only information Setter gave, his testimony is that he gave Officer Waterbury was citing this one vehicle, just one vehicle with its headlights off. That is all that he communicated to him. Officer Waterbury apparently turned around on Fifth Avenue and headed towards Big D. What Officer Waterbury did is he saw another vehicle, a Cadillac, starting to come out of the parking lot at Big D.
Was Big D open?
The Big D was not open. It was not open. It was coming out of the parking lot with its headlights on. At no time did Officer Waterbury describe that there were any violations of law, no equipment violations, or anything going on with this vehicle, except that he saw it coming out.
He never saw the pickup truck, did he? He never saw the pickup truck at all, did he?
I don't think he did.
And the Cadillac was coming out from behind this closed business.
I don't know. That's what Officer Waterbury says.
Okay.
But Officer Setter never saw any other vehicle back there except this pickup. which I think those are crucial facts in this case, as to what Officer Waterbury communicated, or what Officer Sutter communicated to Officer Waterbury, and what was observed when Officer Waterbury got there.
Well, Sutter didn't see the Cadillac, or didn't see it coming from behind.
He never saw the Cadillac.
At all.
At all.
But Waterbury saw it coming from behind.
That's what he testified to. That is correct.
Well, what did the trial court find?
The trial court found that Officer Waterbury testified that this vehicle was coming from behind the Big D.
So aren't those the facts we have to deal with then?
Yes, they are. I don't disagree with that.
Is there any evidence in the record to support that?
Only Officer Waterbury's testimony. And that is it.
And that's evidence enough. We have to follow the version supporting verdict, right, or the supporting the decision.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I have no dispute with that whatsoever. But what happened, picking up the facts where I left off, rather than pursue, and I said, I want to stop right there. One other fact that came up during the motions hearing is that I had inquired of the chief of police, and he was called in as a witness, as to were there any suspect vehicles. A pickup was a suspect vehicle in these burglaries. Rather than Officer Waterbury pursue this pickup, which had just left, he stops the Cadillac, is what he does.
But again, he never saw the pickup.
He never saw the pickup. But Officer Sutter communicated to him that it was headed south on Highway 85. That's what he had communicated. But the point is, we've got these multiple burglaries. We've got a pickup. A suspect vehicle has been described as a pickup. And Officer Waterbury stops a vehicle that isn't violating the law, that isn't a suspect vehicle. Rather than attempt to locate what could be the burglars, he stops a different vehicle. The other thing that becomes evident from the facts, and it didn't stick out in my mind as much when I was preparing the brief in this case as it does when you sit around and you think about it and your mind has an opportunity to relax. When Officer Waterbury stopped this vehicle, the testimony is they were thinking about these burglaries that had occurred prior to this. Officer Waterbury had no backup. Nobody else responded to the stop. Officer Sutter, I believe the facts indicate, he had left his position on National Street and was somewhere else. Officer Waterbury had stopped this vehicle, and Officer Sutter did not come to the scene until he was summoned by Officer Waterbury to bring the canine to that particular area. And it's obvious there wasn't a great concern about this Cadillac, or there would have been somebody would be backing him up at this particular time. The evidence doesn't indicate that Officer Sutter was responding to any other calls or any other disturbances or anything. What eventually happens is Officer Waterbury, his testimony is the reason he stopped the Cadillac was to see what he was up to. There were some questions going on. He talked to him, found out his driver's license was under suspension. I believe they entered the car. Eventually, the drug dog was brought over, and Officer Sutter got the canine out, went around the vehicle twice, and it indicated.
Now, did he actually stop the vehicle and get out and go through the facts on how exactly he stopped him and asked him what he was going on?
My recollection of those...
The vehicle stopped and he drove up and asked him that, or did he actually stop him?
I don't think... My recollection is he didn't even turn on his red lights. He actually turned on his flashers. And what they did is, as Officer Waterbury was pulling in, my client was pulling out or starting to pull out, and they met each other like this. So they're alongside of one another, and I think they just talked through the window is what they ended up doing. And Officer Waterbury, at some point in time, they were in his patrol car. And the reason I'm sure that the red lights weren't activated, because there was a question as to, well, why wasn't the video ever on, and why didn't we see something from the video? Because the videos are activated when the red lights are activated, and that didn't happen in this particular case. So Mr. Berge is with Officer Waterbury. There are some questions that lead Officer Waterbury to believe that my client was trying to hide something. He wanted to get out of there. He says, issue me the ticket, let me get on my way. those are the things that prompted Officer Waterbury to contact the canine officer, Officer Setter, and bring the dog over. So he brought the dog over, and he goes around, he does his thing with the reward. The dog goes around the vehicle once and indicates. This dog indicates by scratching on the driver's door is what he did. Officer Setter brings the dog around again. It indicates again by scratching on the door. Then they conduct the search. Then there is there's marijuana. There is methamphetamine located. There's various pieces of paraphernalia located.
Didn't your client, though, make some admissions prior to the dog going around the car?
Yes, I believe he did in the patrol car with Officer Waterbury. Officer Waterbury made some statement to the effect like, are we going to find something or is there something that shouldn't be in there, something to that extent. And although my client did not say what it was, he gave an affirmative answer to that. That's what he did. So what ends up happening is they take my client, he's questioned, he's Mirandized later on, and he is arrested. Now, the reasonable suspicion standard, the law on reasonable suspicion, really hasn't changed over the years. It's, you know, whether or not, you know, there's a reason to believe that some criminal activity is going on is a standard before you can stop a vehicle, a Terry stop.
In the reverses, so that cop cannot go on, or officer cannot go on a frolic. Are you saying this was a frolic?
I wouldn't want to use the word frolic, but I would say there was no reasonable suspicion. But when I look at the case law, the word I would use, he was acting out of mere curiosity more than anything else. Not because he knew of a violation of law, not because there had been any reported burglary, a burglar alarm, or anything like that. Not only a big D, but not even in this area. And the last reported burglary was actually 3 days earlier. There had been no activity, no reported activity prior to this time.
Well, do you have to have a burglary that night? Or within 5 minutes, or 5 days, or 5 weeks, or...
And I guess I had predicted that question would come up, Justice Zinner. I guess all I can say is one of the cases that's been cited by the state, and I don't remember if it's Aubert or Herbold, we can start with 20 minutes, I think, is what we can start with. Because one of the cases that indicated that police officers had approached a vehicle that was parked in a parking lot at a medical mall dental facility that had been broken into 20 minutes earlier. And this court said 20 minutes earlier, you know, given the location of the vehicle, and the time with respect to the report was certainly sufficient. So I don't know if there's a magic number.
Well, that was one burglary. Here you have a series of burglaries that had gone on over a number of days.
That's correct.
Isn't it reasonable to assume that activity may not have stopped since it had already occurred over a number of days?
Well,
wouldn't it be reasonable to assume it may occur again within a couple of days?
I think it's reasonable for police officers to assume in their duties that it could happen again. But I think the law still says that you got, before you start stopping people and checking them out for burglaries, you still have to have something affirmative, some sort of conduct on the part of an individual to still stop them and check them out.
What about driving out from behind a closed business at 1 a.m. in the morning? Is that enough?
I don't think that's enough, especially without any reports of any activity of any kind going on. This was not a business that had been broken into. The state indicates that there was another business.
How far away is this in the record? How far away this business was from the other businesses that had been broken into?
There's a map in the record that gives you a location of the businesses. It's not across the highway. It's back off to the north, and I believe the other business in the closest proximity was a Dakota Loop, is what it was.
Within a few blocks radius?
Though? It's probably within a few blocks. I don't think I could say it would be a half mile, but within a few blocks is what it is. But I want to follow up what you're asking, Justice Meyer Henry. If a vehicle driving through a dark parking lot That would mean every time somebody drives through a dark parking lot, that's a reason to stop it.
Okay, but then you add on to that, under the totality of the circumstances, the police also knowing that businesses in this same area have been broken into and that they had just seen a vehicle pull out of that very same parking lot, a truck, which was what you said was a suspicious vehicle, without any lights. Add all of that together. Does that make a difference?
I think it makes a difference in where the focus of the investigation should have gone. That immediately, I would think the focus of the investigation would not be on the Cadillac. That in all probability, you've got to shift it to the pickup. That this vehicle hasn't done anything wrong. Had there been another report, if there had been two vehicles involved in these burglaries, if you throw that fact in here, I think that could change it. I think that could change. But
what is the coincidence factor of two vehicles coming out from behind or coming out from the Big D parking lot, a business that's closed, at 1 o'clock in the morning?
What's the coincidence factor of
that? In Belfouche, South Dakota.
If I throw in the fact that this is a truck stop, I think it becomes less of a coincidence, is what it does, because it's an active truck parking lot. There are trucks parked there. There are vehicles parked there during the evenings. I think that changes the scope of what's going on. But you throw that in there, but you throw in this other vehicle, a Cadillac. I mean, Belfouche doesn't have a lot of Cadillacs driving around. You throw that factor
in. So then it's a stranger to Belfouche, huh?
Well, there aren't a lot of Cadillacs driving around.
Is that in the record?
No, that's probably my personal observation. But has there been more?
Was this a... is it in the record whether he had a local license plate or something like that?
I believe it says a North Dakota license plate is what he had. But I don't think Officer Waterbury was able, I don't think he identified that at the time that he stopped him, and that wasn't a reason for stopping him. Okay. It wasn't a factor that he considered anyway.
Because if you'd seen a Cadillac driving out and the officer says, well, that's Joe in there, he works at Big D, or he's got a reason to be here, doesn't an officer have a right to stop car coming out of a closed business parking lot with out-of-state plates and saying, why are you here?
I don't think so. I respectfully disagree, Justice Gilbertson, because that would give a police officer the right to do that, to ask that question anytime they see anybody anywhere, I would think. If somebody's walking down the sidewalk by the Capitol building at night, they have no business being there at night other than taking a walk, that would say, to me, that would suggest an officer can stop that individual and say, why are you walking through here? This is not a residential area. You obviously don't live in the Capitol. I think that opens up Pandora's box is what it does. And to a certain extent, we want to keep the box closed or not necessarily closed, but don't open it up that far. But I would think that there are additional facts, and I want to get back to the Cadillac. Had there been a report of two suspect vehicles, I think that would change the dynamics of this considerably. But the focus of what had been observed was on this pickup. And I don't recall ever asking the question at trial or a motion hearing, why didn't you stop the pickup? Why didn't you pursue the pickup? But that question goes through my mind many, 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 many times, is what happens. Now, the other thing they didn't know is whether or not these two vehicles had actually ever been together, whether or not the pickup and the Cadillac met one another at any point in time. But that doesn't come up until later on. And I want to move on to my other two issues right quick because I'm winding down on my 20 minutes. The drug dog reliability, and I'm going to go to my motion for a court-appointed expert. The reason for that may be somewhat obvious is that this attorney doesn't have that experience, simply doesn't have that experience. Drug dogs are not something a layperson is going to know anything about. That's obviously the reason we made the motion for a court-appointed expert, was to assist me in the defense of my client. Judge Bastian had indicated that he has been exposed to Dr. Craig before, didn't think he would help this case at all, denied that motion. So in an attempt to rectify his concerns, another motion was made to obtain a different expert, who is Mr. Gonzalez, as I recall. We made that request. That motion was denied. As I recall, Judge Bastian had indicated that this issue has basically been resolved. And so that motion was not granted. I ended up relying upon my former partner, Bob Morris, was a drug dog expert in the Army. And I relied upon him trying to help me assess what do I attack or what do I look at with respect to this drug dog. And we had some very interesting conversations.
And we'll end there.
We will end there.
Thank you. You have 20 minutes, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm here to present the state side of this case. Regarding the facts, I generally agree with the facts as presented by Mr. Schreiber, with a few exceptions. There were, on the two nights in February 2004, before the actual stop of Mr. Berge, the first night there were two burglaries. The second night, and this was two nights later, I believe, there were six. That crime wave, which is what it was, given the scale of Belfouche, caused the police to call in reserve officers, to put officers out on stakeout, and to increase the patrols in the area. We're not dealing with a situation here which is just, well, somebody was in a high crime area. We're dealing with a specific location with a very unusual bounce up in crime. Now, as Mr. Schreiber remarked, Officer Sutter was on a hill overlooking Highway 85 or Fifth Avenue. Highway 85 and Fifth Avenue was the location of all of the burglaries, the previous burglaries. There was a Taco John's near Sutter's location, and there was another shop, as Mr. Schreiber described, which was, I believe, closer and across Highway 85 and up a couple of blocks. We're dealing with a very limited area here. Belfouche is not a big city. And that, I think, distinguishes many of the cases that he cites. At any rate, Sutter testified at the suppression hearing that his view of the parking lot and the surroundings of the Big D was somewhat obstructed. I'm not sure whether it was trees or a rise in the ground or what, but he couldn't see the whole thing. First thing he noticed through binoculars was the pickup truck pulling out, I believe, from behind the building with the headlights off. Now, that in itself is suspicious. Again, it's, 12:59 in the morning. Sutter calls Waterbury, who's patrolling nearby, and asks him to come down and check it out. Sutter saw from the hilltop Waterbury turn around and head in that direction. Now, Waterbury got to the scene at 1:02. The actual testimony was before 1:02, but it may have just been a few seconds. So we're talking 2 or 3 minutes. By 1:07, Waterbury had, when he pulled in, he saw the defendant's car pulling out, again, from behind the Big D. There's no reference to any other vehicles in that lot at the time.
So there was no testimony that there were any other vehicles. I see the court just makes a finding that he was unable to see if any other vehicles were in the parking lot.
Yes.
Was there testimony that there really weren't any?
There was no testimony that there were none at all. But he did not see any. He did see the pickup pull out. That drew Waterbury. When Waterbury came in, and keep in mind this is 2 to 3 minutes after Waterbury was called by Sutter, the Cadillac is pulling out. Now Sutter, at that point, left and went to find another place to stake out, to watch for suspicious activity.
Was there ever any more communication between the two officers?
Yes, at 107, I believe. Yes, 107, Waterbury called to Sutter to ask him to bring the drug dog.
But Sutter never indicated back to Waterbury that he was chasing down the pickup truck without his lights on.
No. In fact, Sutter was not trying to pursue the pickup truck. And there's no indication that Waterbury ever saw the pickup truck. It had apparently left on its way. There's no discussion really in the hearings or a trial of what happened to that truck. What Waterbury did.
How do your facts differ? If I understood right, you were going to distinguish a couple of things about the facts that are different from what Mr. Shriver said. How are your facts different?
There were more burglaries, and that was the primary difference. And also, I don't think Mr. Shriver described the sequence of events as being as compressed as they really were. We're dealing just with a matter of a few minutes here.
Okay.
He is correct in saying that Waterbury, when he saw the defendant's car, did not notice any illegality or any irregular driving. Where the reasonable suspicion comes in is from the combination of the crime wave over several nights, the pickup truck pulling out with its headlights off. That's surreptitious, and I think that indicates that somebody's trying to hide something. Waterbury gets there within 2 to 3 minutes, and another vehicle pulls out from behind. Now, what are these vehicles doing behind a closed truck stop? I think Waterbury had sufficient reasonable suspicion, the information that he had, to look into it further. Case law talks about stopping someone and asking for their identification to see what they're doing as a minimal intrusion. And I think that's what happened here. I think when you balance the scale between the threat of additional crime, specifically burglaries on that stretch of road in the middle of the night in Belfouche, I think that the interest in investigation outweighs the minimal intrusion on Mr. Bergen. Now, there's no indication Waterbury turned on his red lights or ran his siren or anything, but he did stop Burby as he was driving by. They stopped side by side, and Waterbury asked for his name and driver's license, and it turned out he said that he had no driver's license. Waterbury then ran a check and found out that Berge's license was suspended in 3 states. He noticed that Berge was talking quickly, some of his answers were a little odd, and called for the drug dog. All that time, he had indicated to Berge that he was going to give him a ticket, and Berge says, "Give me the ticket and let me go. I've got to get back to North Dakota." Well, he can't drive out because he doesn't have a license to drive his car. So it's going to be a long walk to North Dakota. It all just seems a little bit odd and doesn't fit together. But that's sort of beyond the focus of the first issue. The first issue being strictly reasonable suspicion. And I believe that on this record and under the case law, this is reasonable suspicion. Waterbury did not indicate that. He said he really didn't know whether the defendant was up to anything. But the test is an objective one. Would a reasonable officer in that position have reasonable suspicion? And I believe in this case, Officer Waterbury did. Now, going on to the second and third issues.
What about the trial court not granting his motion for an expert?
That's a valid question. One of the problems here is I don't believe there's a sufficient record for this court to really analyze, because there were two experts requested. The first was Dr. Craig, and Judge Bastian indicated that he'd recently had another case involving a drug dog where Dr. Craig had testified, and the trainer of the dogs in Sioux Falls, which apparently was the same trainer as trained Brooklyn in this case, had both testified, and he found that really that Dr. Craig's testimony would not add anything. It really wasn't necessary.
Well, it's on the record that the trial court, who would have been the trier of fact in this case, on this phase of it, had already listened to this expert.
In a different case.
And same dog?
No, I don't know if it's the same dog. I doubt it. I think that if it had been the same dog, that would have been. Now, Dr. Craig is the same drug dog expert, well, dog expert, let's say, who was discussed by this court in State v. Nguyen. And there, he was testifying, and I think this court observed that Craig's background is different from law enforcement drug dog trainers. He has a military background, and that he wasn't. His expertise is different from that of the officers who actually train drug dogs for law enforcement. Now, I think that, and what little record we have of Judge Bastian's denial of that first motion does not indicate that Judge Bastian abused his discretion in denying the motion.
Now, in that Wynn case, there was a lot of information about the reliability of the drug dog that was also presented. Was that in the case here?
Much less. I know in Wynn there was discussion of the specific, case laws. Now, one thing I know that you and Justice Sabers were concerned about was the apparent lack of reliability of the dog in that case, because I think there was something like a 54%.
What was the dog's name in that case? Do you remember?
Oh,
that's fine. We couldn't remember it either this morning.
Crockett.
Was it Crockett?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
A-Z.
Okay.
Yes.
When you have a drug dog request for an expert, is there a threshold showing that the defendant has to make, or as a matter of fairness, should they be entitled to an expert, even if there's nothing in the record to question that the dog wasn't properly trained? What does the defendant need to show?
That's a valid question, because really every case involving a drug dog, if the defendant's position is accepted, would virtually require a drug dog expert to be appointed for the defense. Every case. These cases come up all the time. Now, I think if there is a...
That's no reason not to grant one. That's no reason not to grant one, just because you'd have to grant one in every case, is it?
Not in itself, but I think in order... The statutes and case law like State v. Sally say that the request has to be reasonable and that and it has to be necessary. Now, in this case, what Judge Bastian was saying was that the defendant hadn't proven any necessity here. The reliability of Brooklyn in this case seems to have been very high. Officer Sutter testified that out of 165 incidents, there were only six false indications. Now, it seems to me that is a far weaker showing than existed in, for instance, Nguyen.
But that's no basis to deny an expert to the defense. I mean, that would be like saying, because the prosecution brings the preeminent expert in the country to opine on a matter, the defense doesn't get an expert because the state's case is so good. That's not the standard.
No. I think the emphasis is a little different. I don't think that you can say, well, the state's expert is so good, we're not going to bother to appoint. But I think that the defense has to make some threshold showing of necessity, that there's reason to look at this dog askance. I think in Nguyen, where you have like a 54%.
But how does the defense know that, whether to look askance without an expert? If this is an area that takes expertise, how does the defense even know what questions to ask?
Well, I think that if there's a showing that there's a high error rate, then that would be enough to get by. And, the defense can discover all of that, before a hearing, before a trial. It can look to see if there is anything there which raises any flags.
Well, isn't it moot, though? I mean, as I understand it, the police officer asked the defendant if there was anything that he would find in the car that would be illegal or something to that effect. And the defendant said yes. So the drug dog came afterwards. Once he said yes or gave an indication that there was something illegal in the car, doesn't that create probable cause? He didn't need a drug dog after that.
Well, I don't think in this case. The trial court found that the admissions were made after the drug dog had hit on the car, but before the drugs were found. And I think that created some confusion, but the trial court did not find that way. Now, I think it may well be moot for a different reason, in that the defendant was driving without a license. The Captain Ruberdeau of the Belle Fourche Police testified that the procedure was that the car would be impounded since the defendant couldn't drive it, and it would be inventory. And the inventory would have turned up the drugs.
But there wouldn't have been an arrest for that alone. He would have just got a ticket. Is that right, for no driver's license? Or would he have been arrested for having a suspended license, and then there would be a search incident to arrest?
That I don't know.
That wasn't decided by the trial court.
No. But back to the expert, I think it's interesting that the first expert they requested, I think a fair reading of Nguyen shows that his expertise really is not all that applicable here to the drug dog law enforcement milieu. And I think the same is true of the second expert, Rodriguez or Gonzalez, because if you look at his curriculum vitae, which is essentially the only evidence before the trial court, it again shows military background, and that's pretty much it. Not law enforcement, not drug enforcement, not familiarity with the specific organization that put on the drug dog training, and which was used here as was in Nguyen. And I think on that basis, since these experts, their expertise is not especially applicable here, that I think this court should find that Judge Bastian did not abuse his discretion in denying the motion for appointment.
Otherwise, the only way you can approve an expert on drug reliability is if you're using a policeman or an ex-policeman?
I'm not going that far, but I think that if an expert has familiarity with the specific training that's involved, then I think that the defense would have a better case. But here, it's the same problem as Nguyen, and it was pointed out I believe it was Hudson. Anyway, it's a federal case that I cited in my brief. It's really sort of an apples and oranges situation. And given the lack of showing, and again, we don't have a transcript of the hearing. We don't have much of a record to indicate what went on before Judge Bastian denied the first motion. And the second motion was essentially denied for the same reason. But there isn't much of a record here. And I think since the burden is on the defendant to provide a record, then under the Corey case, that is essentially waived. Now, if there are no further questions, I'll close out by asking that this court affirm Mr. Berge's convictions.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Mr. Schreiber, you have 10 minutes, sir.
And I want to pick up on the motion with the expert. When a trial attorney makes a motion for an expert, there seems to be some assumption by, not necessarily by this court at all, but that expert is going to be a trial expert, somebody who's going to testify. And that's not necessarily what will end up happening, because I can hire an expert and they can say, you don't have anything here. This guy, this is a good dog, it's properly trained, but you start out wanting that expert to consult with to say, where do I start on this whole thing? That's where you got to start. But as Justice Zinner was indicating, I don't even know what questions to ask until I have that expert. Now, I kind of fell into some good things just by accident in this case with the expert, or with Officer Sutter. One of those is the way he collects his information. He doesn't take any field notes. That's a big concern regarding the accuracy of the information and the way it's collected and the data and the way it's stored later on. If he doesn't take any field notes, I can't look at those to determine how reliable this dog is. But what he does is at some point in time later on, he puts them into a software program. A software program that he hasn't even been trained with. A software program that isn't even approved by the International Congress of Police Drug Dog Handlers or something like that. So I can't even evaluate the software program to see whether or not how the information is put in there and what it kicks out does anybody any good. The other thing that, at least from a layperson's standpoint, when I was visiting with Officer Sutter, concerned why this dog hits or what causes this dog to indicate. Officer Sutter made it clear this dog indicates because it wants the reward. It knows it's going to get the reward if it indicates. If it indicates. Not because it goes into odor or smells anything, but because it gets the reward. And when you look at how drug dogs, or how this drug dog is handled, they don't even do the search. Officer Sutter didn't even do the search of the vehicle to confirm the presence of any type of controlled drugs or substances or paraphernalia before the award is given to the drug dog. That raises a question in my mind. Is the dog indicating just to get the toy? Or is the dog indicating because it smells something? And I have no way to sort all that out without the benefit of a drug dog.
I want to go back to the mootness question.
Certainly.
For a minute. The drug dog indicates on the car. The officer, and correct me if I got the facts wrong, the officer then asks your client, is there anything we should know about? And your client makes an admission. Does that admission give the officer probable cause apart from whether the dog had indicated or not?
I don't think it does give probable cause because I don't think the record indicates what they were admitting to. I don't think he's necessarily admitting to anything that was illegal. I don't think the questions and the answers were that specific. And if Officer Waterbury could have gone further, but with the drug dog coming up, I assume that he doesn't have to go any further because the drug dog is probably going to answer those questions if those happen to be the substance of why he's admitting to something.
Now, the trial court, though, also in the alternative indicated an inevitable discovery doctrine and found that your client wouldn't have been able to drive away the vehicle would have been impounded and inventoried, in which case they would have found it.
My response to that, I think that's a little bit of speculation on the part of the police chief. I think his testimony was that's the policy. Whether or not Officer Waterbury would have done that, I don't think we know.
But and there is testimony from the police chief that...
I believe that's correct. And my point is, and I don't... And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I don't think Officer Waterbury, my recollection is Officer Waterbury didn't say he would have done that. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I hadn't thought about that until the question was asked here today.
But the point is, the trial court made a finding on it, and you have not argued that's clearly erroneous.
On that particular issue, I have I have not argued that.
So if it's not clearly erroneous, are we stuck with an inevitable discovery finding?
I don't think you're stuck with an inevitable discovery finding, because I think there's still an issue of law as to whether or not that would have been done in this case or not, because I don't think the facts still support that. But I certainly understand what you're saying. I certainly understand. And I want to jump into, I'm jumping back and forth a little bit, but I want to jump back to the reasonable suspicion argument for a second. What could Officer Waterbury have done? I mean, what could have been done differently in this particular circumstance? What could have been done differently is easy once a person thinks about it more. That vehicle, Mr. Berge's vehicle, could have and should have been allowed to proceed to drive away. Officer Waterbury could have followed that vehicle, could have gotten the driver's, or could have gotten a plate number off of that vehicle. Sutter wasn't doing anything. Officer Sutter, while I'm following this vehicle, can you go back to the Big D and check it out and see if we've got a problem back here? If there's no problem back there, the vehicle proceeds. If there's a problem, he's following the vehicle. If he loses the vehicle, he's got a license plate number.
You know, those are all coulda, woulda, shoulda, hindsight things. Is the reason? I don't think the reasonable suspicion test requires that kind of hindsight analysis, does it?
Well, and I don't even think it's. I don't think the reasonable suspicion test does that. And I don't even think it's hindsight, but I think police officers do that every day, is what they do. They follow vehicles all the time. That's when they make a DUI arrest. I don't know how long they follow a potential DUI until they think they've got reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle. But that should occur in under every circumstance. But when we back up and take a look at the facts, the suspect vehicle in this case wasn't the Cadillac. The suspect vehicle, they let get away. Everything in this case pointed towards that pickup, and nobody pursued that pickup. It was clearly a potential suspect vehicle in these burglaries. And I think I want to back up to the remoteness issue also, because Justice Sinner, you brought that up originally. How long do we wait? I think that's the question this court has got to ask. At some point in time, the remoteness issue, it wears off. You know, when do you stop worrying about it? Well, police officers are going to worry about burglaries every day of the week. That's what their job. That's why they patrol the city. That's why they patrol the businesses. But one other thing in respect to the businesses that were broken into, three of the businesses that were broken into in this case prior to this evening were right in the general area where Officer Sutter is located. He's sitting on top of National Street. Right below him is Taco John's, Subway, and Green's Alignment. The record will support that. There's a map in the record that supports three of them are in this location. The record will support that this is almost in the middle of town and that Big D is basically at the south end of town, which is probably a mile away. All the burglaries were in that area where Officer Sutter was, but other burglaries, and I believe there was West Tire was another one that was identified, is actually on the far north end of town. I think that's another important consideration in this case.
Well, but wait a minute, though. I mean, a burglar with a car in 1 mile, that's not much of an obstacle.
I understand that. I certainly understand that. And my point is, the focus of these burglaries wasn't at the south end as much as it was towards the center. Most of the businesses in Belfouche, which I think the map will show you, are located in the center and towards the north end of town. Although, finally, Belfouche is starting to have some economic growth and we're moving towards the south. But the Big D is basically at the far end, as far south of Belfouche as you can get, right on the end of town there. I really don't have anything more unless the court has any additional questions. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiber.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Come on back in 16 years. Okay. Clerk's in recess for 10 minutes.